to 298 BC. But the Artashastra was probably written several centuries later. The Artashastra begins, like many manuals of statecraft, by arguing that the worst situation for everyone is that of statelessness, of having no ruler. A world in which no one can punish wrongdoers gives rise to the law of the fish, for in the absence of the dispenser of punishment, a weak man is devoured by a stronger man, and protected by him, he prevails. This is a convenient argument for rulers, of course, but it also captures a more general truth. Even for most peasants, there were advantages to living within an orderly state. Here is how the Artashastra summarizes the main tasks of rulers. Agriculture and animal husbandry, along with trade, constitute economics. It is of benefit because it provides grain, livestock, money, forest produce, and labor. By means of that, he, the ruler, brings under his power his own circle and his enemy's circle, using the treasury and the army. What provides enterprise and security is punishment, danda, or the ruler's scepter. Its administration is government. Government seeks to acquire what has not been acquired, to safeguard what has been acquired, to augment what has been safeguarded, and to bestow what has been augmented on worthy recipients. On it depends the proper operation of the world. Punishment, therefore, is the foundation of the three knowledge systems. Clearly, this is all about mobilization, about the pumping mechanisms that drive flows of energy, labor, and wealth from farmers and laborers and artisans to society's rulers in order to maintain a stable state. Much of the manual gives advice about collecting taxes, choosing officials, forming and supplying armies and prisons, and ensuring that peasants can produce enough wealth for society to flourish. Good information was vital to mobilization. In fact, successful mobilization meant having more information than those from whom you were mobilizing resources. So much of the Artashastra describes how to build networks of spies, keep court records, and record the government's resources and assets. Censuses were vital. The chief collector of revenue was to record the total number of villages and classify them by their wealth and the amount of grain, animals, money, forest produce, and labor they supplied, as well as the number of soldiers. City managers were advised to find out the number of individual men and women within each group of households in terms of their castes, lineages, names and occupations, as well as their income and expenditures. Local tax collectors were to keep records of how many people were farmers, cowherds, traders, artisans, laborers, and slaves. They also had to list other smaller groups, including magicians, brothel keepers, tavern owners, soldiers, doctors, and officials. Other officials kept records of horses, listed by age, color, health, and origin, elephants, and other important resources. States, like living creatures, are complex adaptive systems, so they share many features with living organisms, and many writers have noted the similarities. In the introduction to Leviathan, Thomas Hobbes describes the state as a huge monster or leviathan. An artificial man, though of greater stature and strength than a natural, in which the sovereignty is an artificial soul, the magistrates and other officers of judicature and execution, artificial joints, reward and punishment are the nerves, the wealth and riches of all the particular members are the strength. Salus populi, the people's safety, its business. Counselors are the memory. equity and laws, and artificial reason and will. Concord, health; sedition, sickness; and civil war, death. The main features of states do indeed parallel those of living organisms. Like the cells of living organisms, states have semi-permeable borders, creating a protected internal region. Flows through the border are vital to the state's survival, so they are carefully monitored. States also have a metabolism that mobilizes flows of energy and resources and distributes them so as to keep the state functioning by supporting elites, the worthy, as the Artashastra puts it, and the armies and bureaucracies that defend and manage the state. For states, as for living organisms, the ultimate source of most energy flows is photosynthesis, which allows farmers to capture energy from sunlight. In states, as in living organisms, flows of energy must be managed with care. Too small and the state starves. Too large and subjects revolt or starve, and flows of energy and resources dry up. Just as living organisms maintain electrochemical gradients that drive flows of energy, states maintain gradients of persuasion and coercion. They use law, education, and religion to persuade their subjects that their power is just. But they also maintain armies and disciplined groups of coercers so they can compel obedience when persuasion fails. This is why the Artashastra treats punishment, danda, as the foundation of statehood. Coercion was fundamental to mobilization in all agrarian civilization, which helps explain the importance of warfare and the pervasiveness of physical punishments in society and within households and families. States, like living organisms, keep track of information about their resources and enemies so they can constantly adjust to unstable environments. Staying alert to dangers and tracking flows of wealth requires some method of recording information, whether you are a bailiff, a spy, or a census taker. That is why all states have evolved some form of writing. Even the Inca Empire in South America, whose writing took the form of knotted ropes, or quipu. Everywhere, writing evolved as a way of recording politically useful information. States have rules, just as cells have genomes. In states, the rules can be found in law books, in the pronouncements of rulers and local officials, in manuals such as the Artashastra, carved on stone pillars, in the collective wisdom of rulers and officials, and embedded in religious traditions. If we think of states as a sort of genus or type of political organism, we can also argue that traditional states evolved over time, as rulers and officials learned new methods of statecraft and acquired new political, military, and bureaucratic technologies. Indeed, the history of states and agrarian civilizations over several millennia has its parallels with the history of the biosphere, as states entered new niches and evolved new methods of rule and new political technologies, as some states vanished, as new genera of states evolved, and as some states got larger and larger and acquired increasing power and knowledge. The spread of agrarian states. States, like farming, appeared independently in different parts of the world. Not surprisingly, they appeared where farming had already flourished for centuries or millennia and was sufficiently developed to support large populations, large surpluses, networks of commerce and trade, and towns and cities. But states and all the bits and pieces that go along with them did not appear in all farming regions. In some, such as Papua New Guinea or along the Mississippi River, farming generated large villages and modest forms of power, but was not productive enough to support large cities or states. As with farming, we can trace the spread of agrarian civilizations within the different world zones almost as if we were watching the spread of an infectious disease. 5,000 years ago, states could be found only in southern Mesopotamia and along the Nile. But already, they were diversifying. In Mesopotamia, the earlier states were based on single cities that seemed constantly at war. Along the Nile, the first states seemed to have been larger, and their cities less important. Within the next 1,000 years, as populations grew and statecraft evolved, the states of southern Mesopotamia became more powerful and controlled larger areas. By 4,000 years ago, there were states south of Egypt along the Nile Valley in Sudan, as well as along the Indus Valley in the north of the Indian subcontinent. In Central Asia and in northern China, along the Huangpu or Yellow River. 1,000 years later, by 1000 BCE, states could be found around much of the eastern Mediterranean. In southern China, particularly along the Yangtze River, and in parts of Southeast Asia. Powerful chiefdoms that would eventually evolve into full-blown state systems could also be found in Europe and in West Africa. 2,000 years ago, there were also states and agrarian civilizations in the American world zone, particularly in Mesoamerica and the Andes, and they had the same basic metabolic machinery as the states of Afro-Eurasia. States and empires were becoming more powerful and wealthier, but they were also reaching over larger areas and controlling larger and more diverse populations as the technologies of government evolved. The Estonian scholar, Rein Taagepera, has tried to calculate the increase in the areas under states. By his estimates, the earliest states covered a tiny part of the earth in 3000 BCE, perhaps just 1/10 of a megameter. A megameter is equal to 1 million square kilometers, or about the size of the modern state of Egypt. Between 2000 and 1000 BCE, the area under states increased to perhaps 1 or 1.5 megameters. But this was still the equivalent of only about 1% of the area ruled by states today. Most of the world was still inhabited by independent farming villages and foragers. The millennium between 4,000 and 3,000 years ago, between 2000 and 1,000 BCE, reminds us that states could fall as well as rise. In the Indus Valley in modern Pakistan, an entire system of states broke down, leaving behind only rich archaeological remains and tantalizing inscriptions that have not yet been deciphered. But after 1000 BCE, the momentum returned and new states appeared in new regions, while older state systems flourished and expanded. The Achaemenid Empire, founded by the Persian Emperor Cyrus around 560 BCE on the remains of the Assyrian Empire in northern Mesopotamia, probably counts as the first mega-empire. At its height, it may have controlled 6 megameters. 2 centuries later, the Mauryan Empire in northern India may have extended over 3 megameters, while in China, the Han Empire was as large as the Achaemenid Empire. By 2,000 years ago, when the Roman and Han empires flourished, the first state systems were appearing in Mesoamerica and the Andes, though they were smaller and less populous than the mega-empires of the Afro-Eurasian world zone. Taagepera estimates that 2,000 years ago, state systems controlled about 16 megameters, or about 13% of the land surface of the Earth. The spread of states and civilizations stimulated new forms of collective learning as technologies, commodities, ideas, religions, and philosophies diffused over vast areas within the larger world zones. The expansion of populations, trading systems, and state systems was driven not just by the increased flows of food and energy from farming, but also by innovation. With more people living in a greater diversity of environments, information and innovations accumulated faster than ever before. Particularly important were technologies that accelerated exchanges, such as new forms of money, or improved ships or roads. The empires of Afro-Eurasia were all great road builders. Roads were, after all, the arteries of empires. Rulers built roads so their armies and merchants could move faster and farther, but they also established courier systems so that they could learn quickly of revolts or enemy threats. The royal road from Susa in Persia to Sardis near modern Ephesus was built by the Achaemenid emperor, Darius, and described by Herodotus. It extended over 2,700 kilometers and allowed couriers using relays of fresh horses to cover in 7 days a distance that would take walkers 90 days. Writing allowed rulers to store important information about their empires and their subjects. New military technologies, such as better horse harnesses or camel saddles, or more powerful catapults or faster chariots, transformed warfare, while improved communications by land and sea transformed commerce and eased the transport of farm produce. From the time of ancient Sumer, new metallurgical technologies spread throughout the Afro-Eurasian world zone, beginning with bronze, an alloy of copper and tin. From about 3,000 years ago, furnaces were efficient enough to smelt iron, which was tougher than bronze and also cheaper, because iron ores were much more common and accessible than tin or copper ores. In the Iron Age, from 1000 BCE, metals were used for weapons, farming implements, harnesses, carts and carriages, and even for ordinary household goods such as pots and pans. Collective learning shaped educational, philosophical, and scientific thought, and lay behind the rich theologies of the major state religions, all of which incorporated origin stories in their accounts of the world. Most states tried to influence the religious ideas of their subjects, so they built temples and supported official priests. Often, they persecuted shamans and other religious figures who preserved unofficial religious beliefs and practices. The earliest states worshipped local deities, but as states expanded over larger areas, their gods too seemed to acquire greater powers and greater reach. In the largest empires, we see the emergence of supreme deities, such as the Zoroastrian god Ahura Mazda, the supreme god of the Achaemenid Empire. These were gods whose worshippers saw them as universal rulers, just as the empires that worshipped them claimed to rule over the known world. All the major world religions, including Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, as well as the religious traditions of Rome and Greece, of Hinduism, Buddhism, and Confucianism, and the religious traditions of American empires, incorporated superhuman gods. And for the most part, rulers and the leaders of institutionalized religious traditions worked closely together because they understood how powerful religious beliefs could be as a way of generating support for systems from which they both benefited. Skillful rulers learned many ways of increasing their wealth. They tried to protect peasants from over-exploitation, because they understood that most of their wealth came from peasant villages. it was dangerous to oppress peasants too much, and sensible to protect them from enemy armies or predatory landlords, and support them with grain stores when crops failed. As the Artashastra pointed out, peasants were the economic foundation of each state, so wise rulers wanted peasants to prosper. Skillful rulers also encouraged international trade in order to get rare and valuable strategic goods such as precious jewels or silks for the wealthy, tin to make bronze, or even grains to feed their cities. Many also traded people, as the capture and sale of slaves as laborers, servants, and soldiers flourished in the steppes and the huge slave markets of the Eastern Mediterranean and Central Asia. Those rulers who profited most from trade invested in markets and caravanseries, protected merchants, and built roads, waterways, and harbors to move goods faster and farther. As states expanded, so too did networks of exchange. By 4,000 years ago, Mesopotamian cities were already trading with India, Egypt, and Central Asia, while parts of Central Asia were trading with China. By 2,000 years ago, such networks carried large amounts of goods, including silks, coins, glassware, and spices, right across Afro-Eurasia over the land routes known as the Silk Roads, and through the sea routes of the Indian Ocean. These international exchange networks also carried goods no one wanted, including diseases such as smallpox and the bubonic plague. Plagues, such as those under the Byzantine Emperor Justinian I, about 1500 years ago, may explain the slowing of population growth between 2000 and 1000 years ago in the more densely settled regions of Afro-Eurasia. By 2000 years ago, there were large empires right across Afro-Eurasia. They included the Roman, Sasanian, Kushan, Mauryan, and Han empires. And there were many smaller semi-dependent states in between. During the next millennium, between 2000 and 1000 years ago, some of the larger empires collapsed, including the largest of all, the Roman and Han empires. Disease and imperial breakdown slowed growth for almost a millennium. But by 1000 years ago, there were new signs of growth. Villages, cities, and trade networks expanded in previously underpopulated regions of South China, Northern Europe, and Africa. Perhaps most astonishing of all was the rise of new political systems associated with a new world religion, Islam, in the 8th century CE. 4 centuries later, in the 13th century CE, the Mongol Empire was created by pastoral nomads led by Genghis Khan. Though it lasted for less than a century, it was the largest empire that had existed so far, and the first to reach across the whole of Afro-Eurasia, from Korea to Eastern Europe. In the Americas, the first true state systems appeared about 2,000 years ago in Mesoamerica and in the Andes. Many American states, like those of the Maya, were based on single cities, like the city-states of Sumer 3,000 years earlier. By the time of the Mongol Empire, there were also imperial systems in the Americas that controlled many cities and large territories. They included the predecessors of the Aztec and Inca empires. Measuring change in the agrarian era of human history. In the agrarian era, for the first time, we have just enough information to try to measure some fundamental changes in human history. We can try to estimate how human societies used energy, and how energy and increasing complexity were linked in human history, as they were in the histories of stars and the biosphere. The figures in the appendix offer some very rough measures of the role of energy in human history and its impact on human lives. The figures are very tentative, of course, but they are based on some of the most careful estimates we have of large-scale changes in human history. And the story they tell is important and can help us see the broader shape of human history. In the previous chapter, we saw that human populations increased during the Paleolithic, but very slowly, perhaps by a quarter of a million people every millennium in the last 20,000 years of the most recent ice age. The figures in the appendix show the sharp acceleration in population growth after the introduction of agriculture. Between 10,000 and 5,000 years ago, human populations quadrupled, and then between 5,000 and 2,000 years ago, they multiplied again by 10 times. So over the entire period from 10,000 to 2,000 years ago, human populations increased by about 40 times, at an average rate of 25 million every millennium, or about 100 times the average rate of growth of the late Paleolithic. Such rapid population growth was made possible by huge increases in the energy consumed by our species. By 2,000 years ago, humans were using 70 times the amount of energy they consumed at the end of the last ice age. This colossal energy bonanza from farming paid for population growth, for entropy's various complexity taxes, and finally, for the wealth of the rich and powerful. There is little sign that it improved the lives of most humans. Most of the energy bonanza paid for growing populations. But not all, because there was a slight increase in the amount of energy consumed per person after 5,000 years ago. We can't measure precisely how that extra energy was allocated, but what we already know of the evolution of agrarian societies suggests the most important way it was used. It went first to pay for increasing complexity. The statistical appendix offers a very rough measure of increasing complexity, on the assumption that the size of the largest cities indicates the extent of the human capacity to build, maintain, and pay for complex social and technological structures. After all, cities, like civilizations in general, depend on a huge amount of organization and massive expenditures on buildings, roads and highways, irrigation canals, palaces and temples, officials, police, markets and soldiers. We can regard these expenses as part of the complexity taxes paid to entropy. There was also a sort of garbage tax paid to entropy. This was energy from which no one really benefited, and it includes the energy wasted during wars and natural or epidemiological disasters. We know that some of the extra energy from farming also went into improving the lives of the elite groups who made up something like 10% of most agrarian civilizations. Elites controlled great wealth, and it is likely that even the slow rise in life expectancy was largely confined to the powerful and wealthy. So at least some of the energy bonanza from agriculture helped improve some human lives. But after all these other outlays, there was little left to raise the living standards of the rest of the population. That is why all the evidence we have suggests that though people surely enjoyed occasional luxuries, most of the time, most of them lived close to subsistence level throughout the agrarian era. The French economist, Thomas Piketty, has estimated that in most European countries as late as 1900, 1% of the population owned about 50% of national wealth, and 10% of the population accounted for 90% of national wealth. The other 90% of the population made do with just 10% of national wealth. There was really no middle class in the modern sense, because the middle 40% of the wealth distribution were almost as poor as the bottom 50%. The vast majority of people owned virtually nothing, while the lion's share of society's assets belonged to a minority. If this distribution of wealth was typical of most agrarian civilizations, it supports the general conclusion that the energy bonanza from farming improved the lives of no more than a tenth of all human beings. But that's surely the story of most gold rushes. To spread wealth more widely would take one more energy bonanza, one even more spectacular than the energy bonanza from farming. The next chapter describes the changes that prepared the way for Threshold 8, the threshold that would lay the foundations for the astonishing energy-rich world of today. Chapter 10, On the Verge of Today's World. From An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, by Adam Smith. The discovery of America and that of a passage to the East Indies by the Cape of Good Hope are the two greatest and most important events recorded in the history of mankind. By uniting in some measure the most distant parts of the world, by enabling them to relieve one another's wants, to increase one another's enjoyments, and to encourage one another's industry, their general tendency would seem to be beneficial. To the natives, however, both of the East and West Indies, all the commercial benefits which can have resulted from those events have been sunk and lost in the dreadful misfortunes which they have occasioned. From Matthew Bolton, the major investor in James Watt's improved steam engine. I sell here, sir, what all the world desires to have: power. When describing previous thresholds of increasing complexity, we have offered some educated guesses about the Goldilocks conditions that made them possible. As we approach today's world, we can see with much more precision how new Goldilocks conditions accumulated, eventually preparing the way for the astonishing burst of innovation that would create today's world, the world of the Anthropocene. The world 600 years ago. By 1400 CE, human populations had grown from about 5 million at the end of the last ice age to 100 times as many, or almost 500 million people. There were still large regions in Australasia, parts of Africa, central Eurasia and Siberia, and the Americas, where populations were small and most people lived from foraging or hunting or herding or pastoral nomadism. But most humans now lived within agrarian civilizations and depended directly or indirectly on farming. Indeed, most humans were farmers. Many parts of the world were filling up with farmers, just as 10,000 years earlier, some regions had filled up with foragers. Even the Pacific was filling up, as Polynesian sailors set off on the dangerous migrations that took them to most parts of the Pacific. Aotearoa, New Zealand, the last large area of farmable land in the Pacific, was settled about 700 years ago. As human numbers increased, so did the pressure to find new land, new resources, new sources of wealth. Siberian foragers and reindeer herders came under growing pressure from tax officials, fur traders, merchants, and pastoral nomads to trap and sell furs and walrus tusks and forest commodities. In Australia, where there were no agrarian states to press for more resources, population growth forced people to increase production. In fertile regions, such as around modern Sydney, tribal territories shrank as populations grew, and local communities had to develop more specialized and intensive technologies. In Sydney's harbour, in recent centuries, women fished with lines made from karajong bark and special hooks carved from turban shells that let them take fish from deeper waters. They fished at night from bark canoes known as noi, in which they lit fires to keep themselves and the babies at their breasts warm. In 1770, Joseph Banks, who sailed with Captain Cook, saw Sydney's Botany Bay full of the twinkling lights from noi's. In some regions of Australia, there were semi-permanent villages and the beginnings of farming. In some of the larger Pacific islands, such as Hawaii, Tonga, and New Zealand, farming was productive enough to support small townships and small states. In Central America and in the Andes, agriculture had spread over large enough regions to support not just large states, but the first American imperial systems. The core region of the Aztec Empire, which evolved rapidly in the 15th century, was in modern Mexico. Its capital, Tenochtitlan, was where Mexico City is today. The heartlands of the Inca Empire, its contemporary, were on the slopes of the Andes in Ecuador and Peru. The Inca capital, Cusco, was in the southeast of modern Peru. Population pressure and competition to mobilize new resources were felt most acutely in Afro-Eurasia, the oldest, largest, most populous, and most diverse of the world zones. As they looked for more energy and resources, rulers, entrepreneurs, and land-hungry peasants competed for new farmable lands and new forms of wealth, including furs, spices, and minerals. And they were always willing to push aside forages if necessary. These pressures drove peasants to settle in lands they might once have scorned, in the north of Scandinavia, for example, or in parts of Ukraine and Russia, on the edges of the arid Eurasian steppes. Mobilization pressure thickened and diversified networks within Afro-Eurasia, increasing their size and the wealth and diversity of the goods and ideas they exchanged through the Silk Roads or through the maritime routes of the Indian Ocean. In 1400, a concentrated band of people, cities, and farmlands stretched from the Atlantic Ocean along both sides of the Mediterranean through Persia and parts of Central Asia and into India, Southeast Asia, and China. The richest and most populous empire in 1500 was ruled by the Ming Dynasty in China. In the early 15th century, the Ming Emperor, Zheng He, sent out vast fleets captained by a Muslim eunuch to travel through the Indian Ocean to India, Persia, and the rich ports of East Africa. Zheng He's ships were some of the largest and most sophisticated that had ever been built, and their many voyages provide an interesting foretaste of the globalization that was just around the corner. But after 1433, under a new emperor, Hongxi, the Ming abandoned these expeditions. China was wealthy and pretty self-sufficient, so Zheng He's expeditions had little commercial value. Besides, they were extremely expensive. The new emperor and his advisers decided that the money spent on them could be put to better uses, such as defending the empire's northern borders from pastoral nomadic invaders. Rulers with fewer resources and smaller populations had more reason to seek wealth beyond their borders. Expanding particularly rapidly in the 15th and 16th century was the young empire of Muscovy. Its governments built lines of forts that pushed its frontiers south toward the fertile but arid grasslands north of the Black Sea, southeast toward the Silk Road markets of Central Asia, and east into the rich fur and mineral quarries of Siberia. The Ottoman Empire was the most powerful empire in the Muslim world. By the 16th century, its power reached into southeastern Europe, through Mesopotamia, and across northern Africa. After the conquest of Egypt in 1517, it also controlled the lucrative trades from the Indian Ocean into the Mediterranean and on to Europe. In the same century, a rival Muslim empire emerged in the Indian subcontinent, the Mughal Empire, founded by Babur, a descendant of the Mongolian emperor Genghis Khan. In Africa, there were powerful states and empires north of the Sahara, along the Nile, and in West Africa, as well as along the eastern coast, which was dotted with wealthy trading cities. Europe lay at the western edge of the Eurasian landmass, far from the rich streams of commercial wealth that passed through the Mediterranean and Indian Oceans. The Venetians managed to tap those trade flows, but it was not easy. In 1500, Europe's most powerful empire was the Holy Roman Empire, a ramshackle collection of states, bishoprics, and principalities linked by marriage and conquest and extending from Austria through Germany and into the Netherlands and Spain. In 1400, the world was still divided into distinct world zones, between which there were no significant contacts. But growing populations and growing mobilizational pressure ensured that sooner or later, the ocean membranes between the world zones would be breached. Who would do this and when remained uncertain. Though the intense mobilizational pressures in the Afro-Eurasian zone made it extremely likely that the breach would come from within this zone. In 1492, the ocean between the two largest world zones was finally crossed by an expedition led by a Genoese navigator, Christopher Columbus. Columbus had persuaded the rulers of Spain to back his hunch that there was a quick route across the Atlantic from Europe to the rich markets of Eastern Asia. Over the next three centuries, the membrane separating Australasia and the Pacific zone would also be breached. And for the first time in human history, people would start exchanging information and ideas, goods, people, technologies, religions, and even diseases across the entire world. The change was transformative. For the first time since plate tectonics had created the single supercontinent of Pangaea, 250 million years ago, genes, organisms, information, and diseases could flow within a single worldwide system. The world historian Alfred Crosby described this ecological revolution as the Columbian Exchange, and he showed that globalization would transform the biosphere as much as it transformed human history. In the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels argue that these changes kick-started modern capitalism. The discovery of America, the rounding of the Cape, opened up fresh ground for the rising bourgeoisie. The East Indian and Chinese markets, the colonization of America, trade with the colonies, the increase in the means of exchange and in commodities generally, gave to commerce, to navigation, to industry, an impulse never before known, and thereby to the revolutionary element in the tottering feudal society, a rapid development. So powerful was the shock from linking the different world zones that within just a few centuries, human societies had crossed the eighth threshold of increasing complexity. The change was fast because it occurred in a globalized world. In the past, collective learning had worked at local or regional scales, which is why it took 10,000 years for farmers to spread around the planet. In a world of global networks, it took just a few centuries to transform much of Earth. This was a change as momentous as anything that had happened in the entire 4 billion year history of the biosphere. Suddenly, humans found themselves linked within a single global sphere of thought, the noosphere. By the 20th century, the noosphere had become a disruptive force for change within the entire biosphere. Creating a single world system. European navigators were the first to link up the major world zones. That simple fact gave European rulers and entrepreneurs a colossal advantage for several centuries, because Europe, which had once been far from the great hubs of wealth and power, now controlled the gateways through which passed the largest flows of wealth and information in human history. European navigators broke through to the other world zones because they did not enjoy easy access to the rich markets of South and Southeast Asia. That meant they had to take risks if they were to get their share. Most important, they would have to bypass the Ottoman traders who dominated the Mediterranean. That is one reason why, in the mid-15th century, Portuguese governments began to send highly maneuverable caravels armed with cannons to probe around the western coast of Africa. The caravels, with their Latin sails inspired by Islamic models, and their compasses and cannons derived from Chinese inventions, were themselves examples of the intellectual synergies accumulating within the Afro-Eurasian world zone. By the 1450s, Portuguese navigators had already established profitable maritime trades with the Mali Empire for the gold, cotton, ivory, and slaves that had previously been moved by camel caravan across the land routes of the Sahara. These modest successes encouraged rivals. The Genoese navigator Christopher Columbus was one of them. Columbus had persuaded the Spanish rulers, Ferdinand and Isabella, to back him in seeking a more direct westward route to Asia by sailing far out into the Atlantic. He believed, incorrectly, that the distance to China across the Atlantic was much less than many had supposed. Ferdinand and Isabella gambled on his idea because they knew that if Columbus was right, the rewards would be stupendous. On October 12, 1492, his ships reached an island he called San Salvador in the Bahamas. To the end of his life, he was sure he had arrived in Asia, or the Indies, and that is why he described the people he met as Indians. That is also why he was puzzled by their nakedness and apparent poverty, and the absence of kimonos and silken gowns. Captives led him to Cuba, where he found small amounts of gold, and that was just enough to persuade Ferdinand and Isabella to fund more voyages. Columbus's voyages brought the American and Afro-Eurasian world zones into regular contact for the first time. In 1498, just 6 years after Columbus's first transatlantic voyage, a Portuguese captain, Vasco da Gama, showed that it was also possible to reach Southeast Asia by sailing around the southern tip of Africa. The Indian Ocean was not a vast, enclosed lake, as many had supposed. Many, perhaps most, of the early encounters between people from the different world zones were violent, chaotic, and destructive. Suspicion of strangers played a role, but so did the many differences in population densities, technologies, patterns of social and military organization, and even resistance to diseases that had accumulated over many millennia. There were winners and losers, and for the losers, the outcomes could be catastrophic. Like the appearance of the first oxygen atmosphere, or the sudden death of the dinosaurs, this was an example of what the Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter termed creative destruction, the constant often violent replacement of the old by the new, which Schumpeter saw as the very heart of modern capitalism. Many societies were ruined, and many lives destroyed. But there was creation too, because the sheer scale of the first global exchange networks synergized collective learning on a planetary scale, releasing huge flows of information, energy, wealth, and power that would eventually transform human societies throughout the world. Almost all the advantages lay with the resource-hungry states and empires at the western edge of Afro-Eurasia, whose ships had first broken through the barriers between the world zones. They exploited those advantages with predatory glee and ruthless efficiency. Within 50 years of Columbus's first voyage, the Portuguese had used their armed caravels to build fortified strongpoints that bolted together a trading empire in the Indian Ocean. The risks for merchants and sailors were huge, but so were the potential profits. In the Americas, Spanish conquistadors such as Hernán Cortés and Francisco Pizarro seized control of the rich civilizations of the Aztecs and Incas. They did so with tiny armies that exploited political divisions within both empires. But they were assisted by the devastating impact of European diseases such as smallpox that may have killed up to 80% of the population in America's major empires and ruined ancient social structures and traditions. At huge cost to others, the conquistadors really had struck gold, and they enriched themselves and their home societies. In the Americas, Spanish conquerors found more than gold and silver. They also found land that could be used to grow crops such as sugar, for which the European appetite was huge and growing. Spaniards, including Columbus's own relatives, had already shown how to produce sugar cheaply in the Canary Islands, where it was grown on plantations worked by slaves. These plantations gave a foretaste of the profits that would be made in the Americas, often using violence of the most brutal kind. In the 1540s, at Potosí in modern Bolivia, Spanish merchants found a mountain of silver. At first, they exploited it using traditional systems of forced labor inherited from the Inca. But death rates were so high that they soon began to use imported African slaves. Mule trains carried silver to the Mexican port of Acapulco, where it was minted into silver pesos, the world's first global currency. Many pesos flowed across the Atlantic to Europe, where they buoyed local economies, as the Spanish government used them to pay off debt to Dutch or German creditors. Pesos also traveled across the Pacific in the Manila galleons to the Spanish-controlled city of Manila. Here, Spanish merchants and officials traded them for Chinese silks, porcelains, and other goods supplied by Chinese merchants, which they resold in the Americas and Europe at huge profits. This was classic arbitrage trading. Merchants bought where goods were cheapest and sold where they were dearest, and they profited enormously because the gap between production costs and sale prices could be extremely wide in the world's first global markets. The booming Chinese economy needed silver and valued it highly, so silver was worth twice as much in China as it was in Europe, and slave labor in the Americas kept its production costs low. High-quality silk, by contrast, was commonplace in China, but rare and immensely valuable in Europe. As long as their ships avoided shipwrecks and pirates, European merchants and their backers could make huge profits by exploiting the steep price gradients on the first global exchange networks. What the Portuguese and Spanish had started, the Dutch and English continued into the 17th century as they seized Portuguese forts in Asia and began to nibble away at Spanish and Portuguese colonies in the Caribbean and North America. Information flowed down these gradients alongside wealth, and information would prove equally important. The invention of efficient new ways of printing by Johannes Gutenberg in the mid-15th century magnified the impact of new information flows. Almost 13 million books were published between 1450 and 1500, and more than 300 million between 1700 and 1750. Books and the information they stored ceased to be a rare, pricey luxury and became an everyday acquisition for people with education. And just as arbitrage profit stimulated European commerce, huge new flows of information stimulated European science and technology. European navigators found new continents and islands, saw new constellations in the southern skies, and encountered people, religions, states, plants, and animals never mentioned in ancient texts. The tsunami of new information shook up education, science, and even religion throughout Europe, because this was the region through which new information flowed first and fastest. That information forced European scholars to question ancient science and even the Bible. It began to undermine traditional origin stories. In 16th century England, Francis Bacon argued that science and philosophy should no longer rely mainly on ancient texts, but should actively seek out new knowledge, like Europe's navigators. By the distant voyages and travels which have become frequent in our times, many things in nature have been laid open and discovered, which may let in new light upon philosophy. There is, wrote Joseph Glanvill in 1661, an America of secrets, and an unknown Peru of nature, waiting to be found. As David Wooton, a modern historian of the scientific revolution, puts it, the idea of discovery is a precondition for the invention of science. Study the world itself rather than what has been said about the world. Learn how to conquer nature by obeying her, as Bacon put it. This was very much in the manipulative spirit of modern science and technology. In the 17th century, many scholars began to understand that they were living through an intellectual as well as a geographical and commercial revolution, and that new knowledge was increasing human power over the natural world. As to our work, we are all well agreed, wrote a member of the Royal Society in 1674, that it is not to whiten the walls of an old house, but to build a new one. In the 18th century, European thinkers of the Enlightenment era began to see purpose, meaning, and progress in new knowledge. The idea that humans should transform and improve the world began to shape science, ethics, economics, philosophy, commerce, and politics. The world of thought was transformed. David Wooton describes the change vividly. In Shakespeare's time, even the most educated Europeans generally believed in magic and witchcraft, in werewolves and unicorns. They believed that Earth stood still and the heavens turned around it, that comets portended evil, that the shape of a plant advertised its medicinal powers because God had designed it to be interpretable, that the Odyssey was a true history. A century and a half later, when Voltaire was alive, educated Europeans thought very differently. Many collected or read about experimental instruments such as telescopes, microscopes, and air pumps. They thought of Newton as the greatest of scientists. They knew Earth orbited the sun. They did not take magic, the histories recounted in ancient legends, the stories of unicorns,